Introduce the second of tonight's speakers, which is Barbara.
Thanks, Gary.
Hi, I'm Barbara Manaddick.
Hey,
I feel quite strangely calm, actually. Gary says we've got to hit rock bottom by 8:05. That would be difficult. I'm so grateful to be clean. You know, I'm so grateful that I'm clean. And all I did was I came to meetings. I came to meetings primarily because I had nowhere else to go. And I came to meetings, I guess I was, quite a long time ago. I came in, I think, when I was about 26, 27. And next year I'll be 50. And it's just, I mean, I can't afford to be 50. I'm quite anxious about that. But it's been you know, a long, long journey. I'm 8.5 years clean. And in a way, when I talk about my... I mean, I've been here, you didn't do the maths there. I came in at 27, I'm nearly 50 with 8 years clean. I'm not sure a round of applause is appropriate. Because I really messed up quite a number of times. And so I can't really tell my story without revealing how not to do it. And hopefully you take that as a word of warning. So I'm trying to think... chaos. I mean, the chaos of using. I was kind of born into chaos in a sense. You know, I was born in this home in Blackburn, and it was like a home for wayward girls that they were sent away to have their babies and then go back like nothing had happened. And I was in this crazy environment, and I think it left me with a sense of incredible anxiety, an incredible kind of core belief that, you know, life was not safe. I was trash. There was nothing to hold on to. And I was adopted into a home with the woman that I would say was my mother. And that home was also crazy, and it was falling apart. And her husband at that point, he was 27 years old, and she'd just miscarried some babies, and she was really traumatized, and she just wanted a baby so badly. I don't think she thought about what does he want. I think she just thought about what does she want. And she had me, and her marriage broke down, and it was crazy. It was just so crazy. One time we went out, and when we came back, my dad had sold the house. You know, it was like that level of extraordinary 1970s hell. And my poor mum was trying to hold things together, and I was just this little kid, and I was really, really lost. And at that point, we lived in quite a wealthy suburb of Manchester, and we had money, there were really nice animals there, we had a nice big house and so on. And my mum just took me into, like, no explanation, of course, because nobody was doing therapy or reading The Guardian, so things just happened. Really crazy things happened, and nobody said anything at all about it. It was like, okay, what we're going to do now is we're going to go to Cornwall and live with your grandparents in Cornwall, in this place that... there's nothing there. There wasn't even pavements there. It was really, really, really disturbing. And so I was just this lost little kid, and I was constantly experiencing this sense of, like, nothing's going to last and nothing's safe. And my mum had a nervous breakdown, which is, you know, probably the right response to what she's been through. But it left me very alone. It left me very, very kind of neurotic and kind of crazy. And we moved back to Lancashire, and I went to school, but I couldn't really get into school. I couldn't really connect with other people. I liked my own company. I liked living in my imagination. I liked music. I liked escapism. I would just reenact stuff in my head. I lived really, really deeply in my head, and reality was just an inconvenience to be navigated. And, you know, it was my mum married somebody else. She married an alcoholic, and... we went to live on this council estate. It was just so vile. I was always so ashamed of that. And again, it just kept on getting crazy. Just as it couldn't get worse, it just got worse. It was one of those kind of stories. And she was married to this alcoholic, working in a factory. And, you know, I was always on my own in the house because she used to leave the house at 6. And I'd always just be alone. I'd come home. And then by the time I was about 10, I'd start to fiddle around in the drinks cabinet, and they used to buy these boxes of alcohol for Christmas, and then there'd be all the sort of leftover ones, like the stuff that's green, creme de menthe, avocar, and old bottles of port. And I started to get into tasting that kind of stuff. Like, I think instinctively I knew what the cure to my condition was, that kind of really frightenedness that I felt and the not wanting to go to school nurse. And I really, really sought comfort outside of myself, and I sought comfort in substances that were available to me. By the time I was 12, I was really, really into music. Music really woke me up. It gave me something to live for. It gave me ideas about outfits I might like to wear, and it gave me courage. It just made life a bit more fun, and I really escaped into music. And by the time I was about 13, I was into buying albums, ripping up clothes, wearing fishnet tights, dyeing my hair, being out of control drunk. And I was kind of having fun, but I was also in mortal agony at the same time. I don't know if you relate to that. It was just like so painful, but so crazy, and I kind of liked it for a while. I didn't have very good boundaries. I didn't have anybody at home, so I kind of did what I wanted. I wasn't really parented. I was loved, but I wasn't really parented, and so I just very quickly found my way into increasingly more sketchy environments, people using harder and harder drugs, and I would listen to all these. We had this row last night, Gary, about Velvet Underground, but I would be listening to all this Lou Reed, and I would be listening to Nico, and I'd be listening to all these people that basically were informing me that drugs were a really, really, really good idea. In fact, they were utterly poetic, and it was the way forward. And I believed them. And so I was really kind of building this soundtrack to my own life. I was reinforcing that. And if you think that law of attraction doesn't work, I can assure you it does, because by the time I was 17, well, most of my Lou Reed records had actually come true in Preston. And it was awful. You know, I was cutting myself, I was taking drugs, I was sectioned, I would go into psychiatric units. And it's in our readings, you know, where they say jails, institutions and death, they say that many of us sought help in psychiatry. I didn't actually seek help, but I was sectioned into the system. And I found them to be quite lacking, actually, because I would go into these waiting rooms after some self-harm episode that was kind of fairly standard weekend practice for me at that point. And I'd go into these waiting rooms, and there'd be crazy people there, like there'd be people with Tourette's, and there'd be like crazy housewives walking around in their dressing gowns and stuff like that. It was really discouraging. And I knew I was crazy, and I knew that I couldn't function, but I would look at them and I'd think, but I'm not like them. I know I'm nuts, but I'm just like not that kind of nuts. And it was really, really difficult and upsetting to kind of, I did know that I needed help. And I did see the teachers at school, even the ones that liked me, which were very, very few because of the way I conducted myself. But I'd see people looking at me with concern and pity, and I'd see them, the headmaster would come round to my house. I'd come home from not school, I'd left in a uniform and gone on some mission, looking at makeup or something. And I'd come home, and it'd be like the staff of the school in the living room. It was just so, so, so distressing. But I was very defended. I kind of had this real sense that I was invincible and nobody could really do anything about me anyway, and I felt like the strongest person in the room the whole time. And so they would try and help me, and they couldn't help me. And I remember seeing psychologists and just sort of, just, I don't know, I was trying to brush it off, and yet it was really serious at the same time. I dropped out of school. I started to take a lot of acid, a lot of in Preston, because it's quite damp, we have lots of mushrooms, and so we'd be taking psilocybin mushrooms. That was our thing when I was about 17. The unformed mind does not really need hallucinogenics. But anyway, so we would get hundreds and hundreds of mushrooms in this field, and we'd drive them on Hawkwind albums, and we'd order them, and there would be hundreds of these things drying out, and we'd take these trips. We could have taken out half the street, and you know, we would just ingest loads and loads and loads of mushrooms. And then, of course, everything would turn into kind of this parallel universe of elves and goblins, and it was so incredible. And we were listening, again, the soundtrack had changed to sort of Hawkwind, Pink Floyd, all this stuff, and we'd do these incredible trips. And what I was doing was I was absolutely destroying my own psyche. And I was living in a world that didn't really exist except to me. And I remember just
you know, Sunday mornings, we'd go out to Preston Warehouse, which was really cool for a while. You see people like The Clash there, and it was kind of worthwhile, although I can't actually remember anything that happened. And we'd go out on a Thursday night to see, because that was punk night, and then we'd wind up coming to on my friend's floor, listening to Leonard Cohen on Sunday morning, with about 4 brain cells left. And I still think, if I hadn't been listening to Stairway to Heaven, I'd be a lot crazier than I am now. But at least we had some sort of a chill-out zone going. And, oh, God, it was so, so sad. It was a relief to find heroin. That level of chaos and that level of intervention was so frightening and so traumatic that eventually, long story short, I came to London. I've been living in West Yorkshire. I've been doing lots of speed, drinking lots of alcohol. It was to do with the music scene. I always followed the music. I would always hitchhike around and see bands. I was really a disaster. And I ended up in West Yorkshire, and my mum died. And the problem with that was that she was really the only thing that I had. She was the one thing that I had that really kind of anchored me to the planet. And then she'd gone, and I was still only 20 when that happened. And again, what I really hate to see in somebody's face is concern. It really horrifies me. I hate when I'm really upset and some idiot reaches out to touch me, because it just knocks me right over into such trauma. I cannot accept kindness at that point. And it was very frightening to have people looking at me, are you okay? And I couldn't really cope with it. And I came to London, and I got a job in a market research office. And what we would do was we would just call people up and ask them questions. And I realised there was this guy in the market research office, and I felt really drawn to him, which is normally a bad sign in my case. I felt extremely focused on this person. And it turned out that he was a heroin addict. And it was like all of a sudden it all made sense. And I thought, I really, really, really want to take heroin. And so I approached this man who looked like Jesus, funnily enough. And he may well have been as well. And I was trying to convince him. I sort of had this mission now. I was like to convince this man to inject me with heroin, which he was slightly reluctant to do, I can imagine, until he ran out of money. And then I found him quite easy to persuade. And so he showed me how to inject heroin. I promptly died on his floor, as you would, but not for long. And so I became a heroin addict really, really quickly. I would say that I'm a very quick learner when it comes to self-destruction. And I became an independent person. I was able to inject drugs and buy drugs. And I really liked it. And you know what? It's the first time I can joke about it. It was the first time I felt safe. It was the first time I didn't care about anything except that. And you know what? From the life I'd lived, from the chaos that was my head, it was a break. It was a welcome break from the chaos. And I had one focus and one problem, and it was the getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. But you know what? That was the best deal in town at that point. And so that's what I did. I was still, you know, I'm young, I'm shooting up, I'm working in this company, and eventually it closes down. Possibly due to the fact that most people in the company were shooting up heroin, but maybe an unrelated cause. And so I ended up walking around Soho and thinking, well, I don't know what to do next. And as they say, you know, God closes the door, the devil opens the window. And I was walking down Walker's Court, and they had, in one of the sex shops there, they had a little notice, help wanted. How ideal. So I tottered into this store in Walker's Court, which isn't there now, and I became on the retail app, but they would sell all this pornography, and then they would also sell all these sex toys and rubber clothes and shit like that. And so I became the sales girl in Walker's Court. So young. And that was cool for a while, because I only had to work nights. I only had to get there at 6, and then I finished at 12, and then I could buy drugs off one of the clippers on the corner. So it kind of worked. And I'd shoot up in McDonald's, and they'd always have those blue lights, you know, where you can't see your vein, but you can, because it's just a massive great big hole there, so it's quite easy to spot. And it was, you know, horrible, messy chaos. It got worse. It definitely got worse. And then as I continued with that using, I ended up getting methadone scripts and all of that stuff. And I didn't really realise. I would go down to King's Cross, and I was in King's Cross yesterday, and I was there. I went to a lecture on Marxism at Central St Martin's, and I'd never been there, and they've really, really, really redeveloped King's Cross, and it's extraordinary now. It's beautiful. But when I was there, I used to go there every day to buy drugs and do all sorts of stuff, and it was just the most heaviest, depressing place. I remember being in the toilets all the time, being with the most depraved people, such despair. But even when I was going there, I never thought I'd die there. I always felt like so alienated from any environment. I never thought it applied to me. And, I was getting a methadone script from this doctor, and one time she just said, I'm not going to give you any methadone, I'm going to send you into treatment. Which I didn't really understand about treatment, I'd never really heard of it. And so I wound up in Wiltshire, through no fault of my own, in this centre. And I had no intention, like, I didn't qualify for NA at that point. Even when I got here, I didn't qualify for NA because I did not have a desire to stop using, because using was all I had. So although my life was a mess, although I was in a lot of trouble, the taking of my drugs was not something I really wanted to, somebody taking them off me wasn't really what I wanted to happen. And I was in this treatment centre for about 10 days, and it just wasn't for me at that point. I'm somebody that when I really started to get clean, it was in the meetings. There was something about the meetings that I could really cope with more than groups, and I just couldn't really stick with that environment. But I did meet my son's father in there, so I left after a couple of days. I was just, again, not very well behaved, and I left, and one of the guys in the treatment centre left with me, and we had a baby, and he's nice. He's like 23 now, my son. And I just met him in all of this chaos, but the thing was that then I was pregnant, and then I really had to start taking things seriously. And as much as I didn't really care about myself, I really cared about my son, and it really made a difference to me, and I really had to start to look at how to change my life. And I was really lucky because I'd heard of NA, and I came to NA, and I didn't really get clean straight away, and I ended up having to go to this mother and baby detox unit in Brighton to actually do the detox. And then I came back to NA, and it was still, His father continued to use, and I was alone, and I would come to meetings. And the thing with the meetings was that there were people there that I connected with. I started off going to Rathbone Place meetings, again, like 25 years ago. And it was a bit like the holding cell in Fort Apache, the Bronx. It was very chaotic, and I really liked that it was chaotic, because I don't think I would have really been able to cope with anything that had been really orderly. And so it was kind of chaotic, and I made clean friends, and I hung out with clean people, and I started to go to college. You know, my life really, really got better. I did a degree. I didn't really know what to do, but it gave me structure. I'd go to meetings. I would identify with the using. I would identify with the chaos. And the only thing that I didn't really identify was the whole idea of sponsorship didn't seem very appealing, because I didn't particularly like people, and I didn't particularly want to talk about anything. I just didn't really understand how the program worked, and I didn't work any steps either, which was probably the biggest mistake I made. And so I would go to meetings, and I was clean, I was happy, my life was better, everything was so much better. And what I can see now is, when I walked into meetings, I really thought the worst was behind me. And the thing with that was, I was so completely wrong. The worst was so ahead of me, even at that point, even having gone through everything that I've been through, it wasn't as bad as it was going to get. And I think that was what really shook me when I look back. After about 5 years, I ended up meeting this guy in the rooms. And I think the thing with going out with people in the rooms is, really, I would say don't. Just don't bother. One word, no. Two words, definitely not. But I did, because that was the thing. I was always really connecting. I was always looking for something to make me feel better, and I didn't really take things that seriously. And we were young, and so it was fine that it was a bit chaotic. And it was fine that we were a bit promiscuous. Not everybody, but just the people I was interested in were. And so it just sort of unfolded that way. And I ended up going out with this guy, and I'm not sure that he was actually even clean, to be honest. But I went into this relationship with him, and that began my real rock bottom. So having had 5 years of sobriety, I was in a relationship that was incredibly confrontational with somebody who didn't really want me to go to NA. And I know that I have responsibility for that. I know I'm the one that chooses if I put a drink or a drug in my body. I'm the one that chooses if I go to meetings or I don't. But what I've managed to do was put myself into an environment where it was harder and harder and harder for me to make those choices until I lost the power of choice. And I started to drink at that point. And the thing with alcohol was, I didn't understand so much about alcohol. I'd always drank. I'd always been a mess. But I'd really, really focused on using. And so for me, when I was talking about addiction, I was really talking about that one drug and all those ways and means. And I really identified myself as that kind of classic addict. But I didn't understand anything about my condition. I didn't know I still had it. I didn't know I could be addicted to all chemicals, all mood-altering substances. I didn't know that when I stopped using, I would still be an addict. It would still be a condition that I needed to work with. And I always, you know, when I went to an AA meeting at one point, I do remember them saying, alcoholism is what you're left with when you put down the bottle. And that was really revealing for me, because I couldn't really understand why I continued to be so crazy and so self-defeating, even clean. I was in this relationship for about 4 years, and it was just incredibly confrontational. I hadn't really drunk. As far as I was concerned, I think I thought I could drink. I think I thought that alcohol was normal, and I think I thought I'd be all right. And I was so completely and utterly wrong. I never took cocaine before, but I did in that relationship. It was just really, really messy. It was very violent, very confrontational. And I just felt really... I just thought I'd die like that. I remember just self-harming again, taking bottles of pills in front of my son, collapsing on the floor, cutting myself. It was just like the old days, just like another crime scene, you know, just another mess. All the crockery broken, screaming, hysterical, being arrested. And I remember getting a phone call. I was in Brighton at the time, and I got a phone call from social services, and they said, "We're really, really concerned about your child." And I thought, how dare you? What are you talking about? You know, at this point, because I had a really clean flat, clean clothes, he was at school. And the thing is that the police had come to our house so many times because we were fighting that they'd actually reported me for, you know, putting my child at risk. And they said, well, it's not that you're actually going to hit your child, it's that he's in such a violent environment. It's just going to happen. It's bound to happen. It was just the most horrible time. And the worst thing was I always had this nagging feeling that, you know, I should have been clean. I could be in NA. Luckily, eventually, the relationship broke down and I came back to NA. Thank God, it was amazing. But the thing was, I'd lost all my confidence. When I came in at 27, even though it had been very difficult, I had a lot of adrenaline. I had a lot of bounce. I had a lot of energy, and I was able to pick myself up. And when I came back after that four-year relapse, I was a nervous wreck. I couldn't lift my head up. I couldn't speak to people. I was absolutely incapacitated by the things that I'd encountered in that time. And it was very difficult. It was a real long walk. They say in America it's a long walk back to low self-esteem. It was grim. It was really plodding. And even along that way, I still picked up again just one more time. And I think this time I was just so incredibly depressed. I didn't care whether I lived or died. Until again I used. And there was just this point, I remember my sponsor, Mary, and I remember meeting her for coffee, and I knew quite a lot of people, and but I just didn't really connect with it. And I met Mary, and we were having a juice somewhere, and she said, "A juice, can you imagine? That's so messed up." And she said, "You know, I'm gonna take you through the steps." And I just thought, oh, no. Really, I can't bear it. I just can't bear it. But I didn't have the strength to defend myself from this offer of kindness. You know, I'm going to help you for nothing. I'm going to show you how to stay clean. I thought, oh, really? Great. Because I was just so done. And the great thing, Mary was wonderful to me. And she said to me, she said, look, what you've got to do is you've got to list all the things that have happened in your life. You've got to do a list, a chronological list of all the things that have happened. And because I know you, but I don't really know you. And so I made this list, and I had this list, and it was like, I was adopted, then you know, my mum did this, my dad did this, blah, 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 this whole pathetic, tragic list of all these events that had happened, which, of course, I blamed for my addiction. I thought, if you'd have had my life, you'd have used. It's obviously just a perfectly natural response to an unfortunate series of events end. And Mary put me right on that. She said, oh, she said, well, this is really interesting. She said, because this isn't why you used. This is your step six. These are your personality defects. All that disappointment, all that lack of trust, all those emotional breakdowns, all that difficulty, all that abuse, that's your step six. That's why you won't get close to people. That's why you won't speak to people. That's why you won't connect with the only hope you've got of having a happy life. And I heard her, and that was the real miracle. I actually heard her. And I realised that, yes, I was depressed. I was on antidepressants at that point. It's not really for me, but I was just such a mess. And I was depressed, I was addicted, and all of a sudden I understood what was wrong with me. And it had taken 12 years, and some of those years were the worst I'd ever had. And I realised, and then she was saying to me, if you manage your addiction, you can move forward. And you manage your addiction by working the steps. And I thought, you know, I'm really, really sincerely going to give this a go. Not only am I going to work a couple of steps, I'm going to work 12 steps. I'm going to do all of this, and if it doesn't work for me, then fine. It is your fault. I don't care anymore. But next time I relapse, because I'm pretty sure there'll be a next time, it is not going to be because I didn't do the steps. Like, it's just strange how arrogance can move you forward. Thankfully, because it's all I had. And so I did the steps, and it was, I mean, incredible. And now it's like, I wish I'd done them when I was 27. I wish I'd done that. I mean, I would have been young and happy. I could have done so much with my life. I could have had freedom so much earlier. When people were telling me freedom from active addiction, that didn't sound like a very good deal to me, because I didn't understand what they were talking about, because all I could feel was like, no drugs at all, ever. I'm not swearing, but you can imagine. But I went through this process, and we did step one. Can you use safely? Evidently, no. Okay. Step one wasn't very difficult. Step two, will you engage with the program? Will you start to call people, work the steps? Will you come to meetings? Will you do what it takes to get another day clean? I guess I would do that. And that started to work for me too. Step three wasn't so bad for me. I kind of always believed in God. I always believed in some form of God, some idea of prayer, some idea of, you know, it was all sorts of different things. But I didn't have a problem with step three so much. But what was really the greatest gift of my entire recovery, the one I would really like to sell to you, if I'm able to change your mind about anything, was step four. And we did step four, and I remember hearing people talking about step four, and they would say, oh, you know, like, you've just got to write all this stuff about everything that ever happened. And they were saying, you've got to write down every bad thing you ever did. That's, like, not a very appealing thought, is it? At that point, I really didn't want to do that. I didn't understand how that would help, and I didn't understand how you would do that. And then, luckily, somebody showed me how to do a column method, step four, and it's really, really manageable. And all you have to do is write down the name of the person. So it could be my mum, my birth mum, what they did, what it affected, and then there's this not so fun bit where you have to look at your partner. But it was actually really easy, and what I did was I was drinking all this coffee and eating baklava, which I wouldn't do today because of the sugar content. But and I was just writing this complete hit list of everybody that ever annoyed me. Ever. It was the most fun I've ever had. Because the thing is, I can't remember the words of the step three prayer, but I can remember everybody that ever annoyed me, disappointed me, let me down, or genuinely didn't do what I asked them to do, even if I didn't actually verbalise it. I can really remember those people. So I spent a Sunday afternoon just writing down, you did this, you did this, you did this, you did this. It was fabulous. It was really exhilarating. And then I had the book, and it was saying, so this affects my self-esteem, my social ambition, sexual ambition, financial security, etc. So that's slightly more sobering when you start to look at that. And then we got to this fourth column, and my sponsor was really clever. They said, just do the first three columns first. Don't look at the fourth column. It's a good idea, that. So I did all of these first three columns first, and then they showed me this fourth column turnaround system. And they said, what you have to do now is you have to look at your partner and you have to see where, you know, where you've been dishonest. And so you were able to take examples like, you know, my adopted mum. So I really wish that she'd held on to me. I understand that she couldn't, but I really wish she'd held on to me. I really wish I hadn't been adopted. I really wish I hadn't had to grow up with those feelings of separation. And so I wrote that down. I really wish that I'd been in a normal family. I really wish that I'd felt loved. And it's really sad when you do that. It really moves you into like, oh my God, I'm actually really sad. And I look at all the people that I let down. I really wish he'd loved me. I really wish. And I really was able to see how I would have liked life to be different. And I was really able to see, you know, doing step four, it's not about you apologising for somebody abusing you. It's not about you saying, I'm so sorry I got in the way of your fist or whatever. It's not about that. It's about looking and honestly appraising what went wrong and how you would have liked it to be and how heartbreaking that is. And it gives you such a sense of compassion. And I could see that all of the things that happened in my early years that I have no responsibility for, but what happened was, rather than become a victim, I was a victim, I guess, of circumstance, but I became a volunteer and I actively recruited people to play those roles in my life. And I did it from age 12 right through to age 40. It was an accident. I did it over and over again. I constantly connected with people who would disappoint me, that would abandon me. It was all I knew. I was just a stuck record and I hurt myself more and more, and living was unconscionably difficult with that level of pain and anxiety. And I saw it, you know, I saw it for the first time. I saw that people had done their best, and I saw that in and of myself I could change nothing. And I remember, you know, and the one thing just to say, the sponsor that I read my first, one of these step fours to, he came from the same mother and baby unit that I'd been born in. He was born in the same home as me. That's really, really bizarre, isn't it? That you can look at somebody and say, that really hurt. Isn't it hard to grow up like that? Doesn't it make it a bit tough to get close to people and know? And the other thing that was really amazing was, I would sit in meetings and I would see what a 27-year-old man looked like. And I would see that man who left me, that man who left my mother, that man who betrayed us, who caused all kinds of chaos. He was not much more than a child himself. And it gives me compassion. None of it was personal. It enabled me to just look at my defects. I have step three, I have step one, two, and three. I don't have to use drugs today. If I remember my fourth column, if I'm in step six and step seven, I can get out of my own way. I have a daily reprieve from addiction, and I have a daily reprieve from my own personality with any luck, because I'm still capable of going on a bit of a recruitment drive. Now, step eight, I don't know whether I've really... I hurt a lot of people, I disappointed a lot of people, and that really hurts me. I was so angry trying to bring up my son. I was such, even when I was sober and clean, I was still kind of a dry drunk. I was really intense, I was really critical, I was really confrontational. I wasn't the best parent. You know, sometimes I lashed out at him. I really regret that. I can't take it away. I regret disappointing people. I don't mind so much about, you know, material things. I stole from people, I owed banks money, I went bankrupt, so what, so did a lot of people. I don't really care about that, but I care about letting people down. I care about being disappointing. You know, with the other steps, just trying to take a daily inventory. Step 11 is probably where I have the most fun. I think about... I think it's the best step in the sense it allows me to really expand into a world that does feel more habitable for me. I like the idea of the spiritual realms. I like the idea of learning to meditate, doing yoga, making myself feel better. I like the idea of understanding more about God and gods and how the cosmos works. I really enjoy that. I say the names of the dead every morning. There's so many. My son's father died in a toilet. It was so, so sad. It was really hard to see addiction affect my son, and I can't take that back, because when he died, you know, I was drinking at the time, and we got a phone call saying that he died of an overdose, And I could really see in that moment, it's so funny to go to rehab and run out with a guy. It's so funny to waste public money and just try and get laid instead of saving your life. But it's not funny when the phone call comes and it's your kid that's in the line of fire. There's nothing you can do about that. But I did that. You know, what this program has given me, it's so much. I can never, ever repay you. I can never, ever put back what I was given. I'm able to live a life. I don't find it easy. I'm happy. I get to go to Florida a lot. I spend a lot of time on the beach. I spend a lot of time doing little rituals, pottering about, not blow drying my hair, getting in the sun, chilling out, going to meetings. I really love that. I love being on the beach. You know, I've been there and the wind's coming in and the tropical storm's coming in. And I remember just standing by these rocks in Florida in all this weather, just like really at peace, but really exhilarated and really excited. And I'm thinking of that thing when they say, you will know peace. And it was so exciting. I thought peace would be boring. I thought they were saying, you will be bored. I was so excited. You know, I like that I get to go away. I get to go away because I'm clean. I never went anywhere. I went to King's Cross on a bus pass because back in the day you could actually sort of change the numbers on your bus pass. God knows what junkies do today with those Oyster cards. We had like penciled in bus passes, and if you wanted to cash a check in somebody's name, you could just write anything on it and give it to them and they give you 50 quid. It was so easy. I would never have survived. And you know, but I travel a bit now. I get to go and have lots of peace and lots of quiet. And I still find life very difficult. I still step out onto Charing Cross Road. I have no idea what people are doing. I have no idea. I was walking into work the other day and I thought, I'm actually going to start crying. I'm so bewildered by normal things. I really don't quite know what to do. I've just started another set of steps. I'm not using anything. I'm not addicted to anything. I haven't just ended a relationship. I haven't self-harmed. I just thought, I really want to do another set of steps. I really believe in this process. I think the process that got me into a place of peace, the process that got me living a functional life, that got me to treat people with kindness, behave with integrity, that I can sleep at night, I wake up in the morning, all I think about is coffee, I have no other problems. It's like I have such a peaceful and beautiful life with so many incredible people. The program that could do that for me can probably get me to the next level, and that's what I want. I really do want to see what I can do. You know, I've had a white key ring. I had one in my 20s, I had one in my 30s, I had one in my 40s. It would be a great achievement for me if I don't have to pick another one up in my 50s. And yet, you know, I remember Paul said, if you think you're never going to use again, you don't know what's wrong with you. It is about a daily reprieve. I'll leave it there.
Thank you.